From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Goodall about her 33 years studying wild chimpanzees in Tanzania. A chimp war and a chimp attack against her reminded her not to sentimentalize the animals. And why would a man in his 20s put on an evening gown to look like an aging matron? We'll talk to Jack Dorishow. In the 60s, he produced drag show competitions around the country and hosted them in his drag alter ego, Sabrina. A documentary of his 1967 national pageant has just been re-released. And book critic John Leonard reviews Philip Roth's Operation Shylock. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton made another strong pitch today for his proposal to provide more aid for Russia. Speaking before a group of newspaper editors in Maryland, the president characterized the aid as an investment designed to promote democratic reforms and keep Russia stable. He promised that aid would be on a people-to-people basis and would bypass the turmoil in the Russian government. Among potential direct aid programs, the president mentioned entrepreneurial help for Russia's dying oil industry and aid to small family businesses. President Clinton said that he and Russian President Boris Yeltsin will also discuss arms control issues at their weekend summit meeting in Vancouver. Defense attorneys abruptly rested their case today in the federal trial of the four Los Angeles police officers accused in the beating of Rodney King. The surprise move means the case will go to the jury in just a few days. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Only one of the four officers charged in the civil rights case, the sergeant who directed the baton blows, took the stand in his own defense. The others decided it was best that they not testify. Though the attorney for Officer Lawrence Powell, who delivered most of the blows, had said his client would take the stand, defense attorneys collectively agreed Tuesday night that it would be best if Powell not appear. And yesterday, Powell's lawyer rested his defense. Today, attorneys for the other two officers, against whom the prosecution has presented much less evidence, rested as well. One called just a single witness, the other no witnesses at all. The prosecution, surprised by the defense move, said it would not be ready to present its rebuttal witnesses till Monday. The case is expected to go to the jury toward the end of next week. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Democracy talks in South Africa adjourned this evening a day earlier than expected, with the 26 parties agreeing to postpone nearly all issues on their agenda. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The talks that opened here this morning were symbolically important because they mark the first time in 11 months that South Africa's political rivals have sat down to formally negotiate an end to white minority rule. After today's session, though, it appears that the transition to democracy is still a distant goal. Delegates to the talks postponed even the most minor decisions, including what to call their reconstituted negotiating forum. More crucial issues, such as when South Africa's black majority will finally gain the right to vote, were not addressed at all. The parties did agree to meet again later this month. Meanwhile, smaller working groups will continue meeting in closed-door sessions that may prove more productive than today's public talks. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
The Dow Industrials gained 4 points today to close at 3,439. This is NPR. General Colin Powell told a Senate panel today that the United States will leave about 4,000 troops in Somalia through next year as part of the United Nations relief effort. Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that there are now about 10,000 American troops in Somalia, but that he expects the force to be reduced to 4,000 by summer. Powell told the Senate Armed Services Committee that the support forces will be supplemented by a rapid deployment force of 1,000 troops stationed offshore. In New York State, a major new law to reform the insurance industry goes into effect today. NPR's Patricia Namond reports.
Under the new law, insurance companies can no longer discriminate against anyone, no matter how old or how sick. They'll have to sell policies to all comers, and they'll have to charge the same price for the same set of health benefits. The New York legislature passed the law last year, and insurance companies said it would bankrupt them. So far, only 9 small companies have left the state. Most have not. Health experts say that while the new law is more fair, it also means higher prices for younger, healthier people. That's because insurance companies now have to spread the cost of paying for older, sicker people among everyone. State officials say prices for the average consumer will increase 18%. President Clinton's reform plan for the nation will likely include a similar law, but it will also include strict controls on costs, which experts say should keep insurance companies from raising their prices too much. I'm Patricia Namond reporting.
The Federal Communications Commission voted today to force cable television operators to cut the rates for their most basic services by at least 10%. The FCC voted unanimously to adopt regulations that will control the rates for local cable companies that are franchised by municipalities. 57 million people subscribe to cable TV. The basic service includes the broadcast networks. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The chimpanzee is more like humans genetically than any other animal. Perhaps that explains our fascination with chimps. In 1960, Jane Goodall began the first long-term study of wild chimpanzees at Gombe National Park in Tanzania. No one expected her project to still be going 33 years later, but Goodall's research project continues today. And she is now widely acknowledged as the world's leading expert on wild chimpanzees. She spends much of her time now on the road on a crusade to save the wild chimpanzee and speaking out against the cruel treatment of chimps used in lab experiments. Goodall's latest book, co-authored with Dale Peterson, is about the relationship of humans and chimpanzees. When Goodall first began studying the chimps, she was discouraged from projecting human qualities on the animals, but she disregarded the advice.
For one thing, I gave them names instead of numbers. Terrible thing to do. For another thing, the first scientific paper I wrote, I talked about chimpanzees as he and she, and I said, this individual who, and the article came back, and it was substituted for he and she, and which was substituted for who. And then in those days, you couldn't talk about something like adolescence and childhood. You couldn't talk about motivation. You couldn't talk about excitement. There was very, very little you could do in terms of describing chimpanzee behavior in terms that ordinary people would understand.
Do you think that's changed? Do you think that your more personal style has become accepted scientifically?
I think that in most scientific circles today, these things that I've mentioned are accepted. I think people have come to realize that when we're talking about creatures who share over 98% of their genetic material with us, creatures whom we know to have very, very similar central nervous systems and brains, you know, it's completely crazy to imagine that they wouldn't have similar feelings, similar ways of tackling problems in life. Mostly people accept today that that is so.
In writing about chimp behavior, you say that male chimps are more respectful of men, especially men with deep voices, and they take liberties with women. How did you find that out, and what kind of liberties did the chimps take with you?
Really, until quite recently, there hasn't been that obvious a difference in the way they treat they treated male and female researchers. But we now have one chimpanzee who's a rogue, and he's actually very dangerous to female researchers, and most particularly to me. And it's very sad, after 32 years in the field, that one chimpanzee has, in a way, made Gombe feel a little unsafe to me today.
What does he do that's a threat to you?
He's probably 10 times stronger than I am. I mean, a big male chimp is said to be 4 to 5 times stronger than an adult human male. And Frodo is the largest, heaviest chimp we've ever known at Gombe. He's 115 pounds. He's about 20 years old. He's absolutely magnificent. He's one of Fifi's offspring. And what he'll do is display that's charging with his hair bristling, dragging branches and things, straight towards me, pull me over, stamp on me, perhaps display away, come back and do the same thing again. He's actually done it 3 times. He's not trying to kill me, but given the nature of the terrain, the steep, rugged slopes that drop down to riverbeds with rocks far below, you know, he's only got to tip me or someone else over the edge, and we've had it.
I'm sure you've asked yourself why you've become a target of his. Do you have any idea why?
I can only think that it's because of all the people working at Gombe, he has the least fear of me. I've always been able to get very close to even nervous individuals, and that's because I'm calm and quiet, and I don't try to get too close, and I don't push. And so he has absolutely no fear, no respect, no, you know, nothing that will block his aggressive behavior towards humans, particularly me.
I'm sure you've asked yourself what the chimps think of you and what they think of what you're doing there and who you are.
I doubt they think very much now. I think we're just part of the environment. As you know, there are baboons and there are bush pigs. There used to be buffalo. They've gone now, sadly. But there are all kinds of other animals and birds. And we're just part of that natural environment, almost all of them. They grew up with us.
Did you learn to make the sounds that chimps use to communicate?
I can make most of them. Most of the people studying chimps can make those sounds, but we don't actually make them in the wild. I sometimes make them to chimps in captive groups, and they usually reply. Certainly that the little greeting sound, when you want to approach a nervous young chimp, which I have to do all the time, because one of the things that we're doing with the Institute is to rescue orphan chimps whose mothers have been shot by hunters. They're confiscated by the government, and we care for them. And to see some of those pathetic little orphans in the markets being sold at the street side, they're dehydrated, their eyes are dull, they're losing hope, they're losing health. And you go up and you make this soft little which is a gentle greeting, and they'll sometimes put their arm around your neck.
How come you wouldn't use that language in the wild?
Because we've always tried to be as unobtrusive as possible, to keep in the background, to let the chimpanzees get on with their lives, not to try and communicate with them, but to be part of the environment that they will ignore. And, you know, apart from the occasional problem, such as with Frodo, that's the way it works. They accept us, they trust us, we can follow them, and they can get on with their lives.
What else would you say to a chimp in captivity?
Well, I sometimes make the distance call, which chimpanzees at Gombe make when they're calling out from one side of a valley to the other, and they're basically identifying themselves, or perhaps questioning, who's over there, I'm here.
Is that a sound you could demonstrate for us?
Well, I can demonstrate if I just lean away from the microphone, because it's rather loud, but...
How did you learn to do that? I mean, did you practice in the wild away from the chimps?
Well, I practiced away from the chimps.
So I imagine a lot of the researchers like practice this on each other, huh?
Yeah, well, sometimes if I'm giving a lecture and there's some of my students in the audience, I explain beforehand, you know, that I'm going to make this call and they're going to reply, and that always brings the house down.
In all your years in the field studying chimpanzees, were there particular aspects of chimp behavior that you felt you understood and were particularly like your own, particularly like the way humans behave?
Oh, I think a lot. One of the most striking, really, is the non-verbal communication patterns, so that chimpanzees will kiss, embrace, hold hands, pat one another on the back, swagger, threaten by shaking their fists, tickle. And the striking thing here is that not only do the patterns look like so many of ours, but they're used in the same context, so they obviously mean the same kind of thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Goodall, who is considered the world's foremost researcher on chimpanzees. She's co-authored a new book called Visions of Caliban on Chimpanzees and People. She's also the head of the Jane Goodall Institute to further work on conservation of chimpanzees worldwide, and that's based in Tucson. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Jane Goodall is my guest. When you first went to the bush, you were given the opportunity to do that by the anthropologist Louis Leakey, and this was to be the first really long-term study of chimpanzees. Other people, I believe, had studied them for months at a time. You were supposed to go there for a few years. So you got there, and you went with your mother because you weren't allowed to go by yourself? What was that story?
Young English women didn't do that sort of thing. In fact, as I grew up, I was told I couldn't. It's what I'd always wanted to do. But I had this great mother who always used to say, Jane, if you want to do something enough and you work hard enough and you take advantage of opportunities, you'll get there in the end. And so when I was told by the British authorities that it wouldn't be appropriate for me to go out completely on my own without some kind of female companion, my mother was the one who offered to come.
What did she do to help you when you were getting started?
Oh, she was fabulous. She had a clinic. Her brother was a surgeon, and he supplied her with all kinds of simple medications like aspirins and Band-Aids and Epsom salts, you know, that kind of thing, something mm-hmm. that anybody can administer. And she set up a little clinic on the shore of the lake for the local fishermen who were living around the park. And she had so much patience and so much concern and care that with these simple remedies she sometimes worked wonderful, amazing cures. In fact, we found out later that she was known as the White Witch Doctor. And of course this was tremendously helpful in establishing friendly, good relationships with the local people, and those have remained ever since.
How long did she stay with you?
She was with me between 3 and 4 months, and by that time the local authorities realized that, you know, it was okay and I was going to be all right, and I had a staff by then. I had a cook and a boat driver, and I'd made friends with the local people, and they said, all right, you can stay.
When you got to Tanzania and you knew you were there to watch and research the chimps, were they easy to find?
No, they used to run away. The first moment they saw me, they would depart into the undergrowth, and it was very frustrating, but gradually, from an open rocky peak overlooking two valleys, one on the north and one on the south, using my binoculars, wearing the same colored clothes every day, they got used to this queer white-skinned ape who'd appeared so surprisingly in their midst. And so gradually I was able to get closer and closer and learn ever more about their fascinating behavior.
One chimp was particularly helpful to you because he was the first chimp that befriended you, shall we say? What did he do to help introduce you to the others?
He was fantastic. That was David Greybeard. And I probably owe more to him than any other chimp throughout these long 33 years. For some reason, he had a particularly calm and trusting disposition. Of course, every chimpanzee has his or her own totally individual personality, just like we do. And David, instead of running off, would just sit and calmly continue what he was doing. It was David who one day arrived in my camp to feed on the ripe fruits of the oil nut palm growing there. And while he was there, he saw some bananas lying on the table, and he took those. My cook told me about this male chimp who'd arrived, and eventually I stayed down and waited to see who it was, and then that's how I found out it was David Greybeard. I'd already named him from my encounters in the forest. And from that time on, he would sometimes wander up to me in the forest to see if I had a banana somewhere hidden about my person or in my haversack. And the other chimps would start to run, and then they'd stop, and their eyes were big and wide, and they'd think, what is this? What is going on? And so they realized that I wasn't so frightening after all. And it was as though David had opened a door into what was then a really magic unknown world.
What were the signs that you were being accepted by the other chimps?
They didn't run away. They stayed when I could approach, and they would look up. And then they'd continue their grooming or their playing or their feeding or whatever it was they were doing before I came.
Would they approach you and make friendly gestures toward you?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. They just continued with what they were doing.
Did it ever get to that point as time went on where chimps would come up to you and be friendly in a conscious way?
Well, you see, we tried to discourage all that kind of thing. They would sometimes come up to peer if there was a banana anywhere. But as we discouraged any kind of contact, we didn't really have that much. There was one short period. It was before I realized we could make this a really long-term study. And it was so exciting to be able to go up to and groom a completely wild adult male chimp, David Greybeard. It was so exciting when a mother allowed her infant to come up and touch me. It was so incredibly moving when a juvenile allowed me to play with him. And I wouldn't have foregone those experiences, but in a way they were wrong, because it was dangerous to try and establish communication with them. It was dangerous to the objective collection of information.
You become too much of the story and start to change the chimp behavior by your presence and
That's right.
involvement.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very easy to become part of the group. And then, for one, that would disturb the natural behavior more than we do by being there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And for another, it could be very dangerous, because they do attack each other quite often for no very obvious reason sometimes. And they are very strong. And if we were perceived by them to be part of the group, they'd probably all treat all of us the way Frodo treats me.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that reminds me, I think about 15 years into your research, in the mid-70s, there was a war between two groups of chimps who you were studying. And one group was annihilated in that war. Did you know that that kind of fighting occurred?
No, we knew that the males of one social group, which we call a community, patrolled the boundaries of their territory. We knew that if they spied a stranger, they might chase, and if they caught up with that stranger, attack. We knew that they were sometimes extremely brutal to stranger females, but that there would be a sort of deliberate warfare where one by one the individuals of that small group were hounded down, brutally attacked, and left to die. That was a surprise, a bad surprise.
How were you able to watch it without getting hurt?
Because they weren't attempting to hurt us. They were completely concentrated on the victims. And because we have always made this conscious effort to remain outside their social life, they just ignored us. But it's very frightening to see chimpanzees so aggressive when you have five or six fully adult males attacking one victim. It's extremely brutal. And it teaches us that just as chimpanzees have very many of the characteristics that we see in ourselves of compassion and love and altruism, so too can they show a dark side of their nature.
What's their method of fighting?
It's stamping, sometimes biting, dragging along the ground. Those are the main components.
Were you at first gravely disappointed that the chimps had the potential to be as violent as we know people can be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to think, well, they're very like people, but nicer. And then I realized that when opportunity arises, they have this nasty, brutal side to them, just like we do.
You know, when humans fight a war, you always want to know, what is the war about? What is the motivation? Who is wronging who? When chimps fight a war, what is it about?
Well, this particular war is the only one we've ever seen, and we're not too sure. I think we shan't be very sure until it happens again. But I think it was because one main community divided. It just got rather a lot of males, and they divided into two. And the smaller section took over what had been the southern part of the range when the community was one. And I think it was simply that the larger number of males wanted to regain access to that part of the territory that they lost after the split. And indeed, after they'd annihilated the smaller fragment of the community, you know, in something rather like a civil war, they did move with their females back into that piece of land that they'd lost.
Jane Goodall is my guest. Let me move to some human violence that happened in the 70s in your camp. Four student researchers in your camp were kidnapped by Zairean guerrillas. How did you find out what had happened?
It took long, agonizing days before one of the students was sent back. She was able to tell what had happened. She brought the demands of the kidnappers with her.
What were the demands?
They wanted money, and they wanted various things like publicity. They wanted arms. They did not get the arms. Of course, they got the publicity. I mean, it was all over the international press. And they got some money. But the main thing was that the students were returned and they were all safe.
Was that the only time anyone in your group had been the victim of human violence?
Yes, and you see, if you imagine how lucky I was, because so many of my colleagues who've been studying primates or other kinds of animals in Africa and Asia and South America have had to stop their research, have actually been in physical danger because of political unrest. I mean, it's happened again and again and again. Tanzania, apart from that one incident, it's been peaceful. It has been the most politically stable government in the whole of Black Africa.
The site of your research has been a national park in Tanzania. How has the wild changed since 1960 when you started your research?
Unbelievably, and I wish on radio one could actually show pictures, because I have some pictures showing what it was like along the shore of the lake for maybe 100 miles in 1960. And if you go back there today and you go along the 10-mile strip of Gombe shoreline, it's only 10 miles long, this little national park, it looks exactly the same. But if you go to the north or the south, the forested hills, which used to come down to the water green and lush with a few little clearings for the fishermen growing their crops, today there are no trees. It isn't that there's a lot of deforestation, it's that these slopes are completely bare. And the frightening thing is, you say to yourself, well, what's happened? What does this mean? It means that the chimpanzees and the other forest animals have long since gone, apart from a few tiny, pathetic remnant groups that are in the very, very steepest valleys. And then you see how the fishermen have been trying to cultivate these inappropriate steep slopes. You see that every time it rains, the topsoil, this precious thin layer, is washed down into the lake. You realize that the fish breeding grounds in the shallows are being silted up. And you realize that in 5-6 years, if we can't help them in some way, the people will be starving and gone too. And yet there's nowhere for them to go because of increased population and because of refugees coming from Burundi and Zaire. I mean, it's a nightmare situation.
What's left of the chimp population that you've been studying?
The chimps that we've been studying within the park are completely safe, and they're not in danger of poaching, so that as far as wild chimps goes, they live in a kind of paradise. And that, I think, is because we have employed Tanzanian field staff from the villages around the park, not just in menial capacities as trackers or to help us around camp, but they follow the chimps. They make detailed written reports. They use 8mm video cameras. They're very proud of their work. They care about the chimps. They'll look after them if they're sick. They talk about them to their family and friends in the villages. And so, you see, there's no danger of poaching. Plus, by doing this, we're helping the local economy with the wages that we pay.
Jane Goodall, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jane Goodall co-authored the new book Visions of Caliban on chimpanzees and people. The Jane Goodall Institute is headquartered in Tanzania with an American branch in Tucson, Arizona. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the drag show answer to the Miss America pageant. We talked to Jack Darashow. He produced drag pageants through the 60s and hosted them in his drag alter ego Sabrina. A documentary of his 1967 Miss All-American Camp Beauty pageant has just been re-released. It's called The Queen. And book critic John Leonard reviews Philip Roth's new book, Operation Shylock. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Trying to build domestic support for sending aid to Russia, President Clinton told the American Society of Newspaper Editors today that such aid would help Americans as well as Russians. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
It was the administration's strongest appeal so far in its bid to help Russia. Speaking in Annapolis, the president acknowledged that the U.S. has serious economic problems of its own, but insisted the additional burden of helping Russia now will reap even larger dividends for America's safety and prosperity in the future. A reformed Russia would allow arms reduction treaties to be implemented, he reasoned, and would allow cuts in U.S. defense spending, freeing up money to invest in the American economy.
Our ability to put people first at home requires that we put Russia and its neighbors first on our agenda abroad.
Noting that Russia has great mineral wealth and an educated workforce, the president argued that a strong and free Russia would offer trade opportunities to Russians and Americans alike. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
While the president has not said how large a Russian aid plan he is considering, Secretary of State Warren Christopher told a House subcommittee today that most of the money would come from funds approved previously by Congress, but held up by various bottlenecks. Cable rates for millions of Americans will be going down because of new regulations issued today by the Federal Communications Commission. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The FCC today outlined how it will implement the Cable Act, which passed Congress last year over the veto of President Bush. The commission will freeze cable rates for 120 days while it begins a review process that should reduce rates for two-thirds to three-quarters of cable subscribers. Most cable systems will have to roll back their rates to their levels on September 30th of last year, and many more will have to lower their fees by as much as 10%. The FCC's Sandy Wilson says consumers should start seeing results later this year.
I think it's realistic to say summer.
The regulations cover cable systems that hold an effective monopoly in a given area. The amount of rate reduction will depend on how far a particular cable system's rates deviate from a national average. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
American Airlines says it will lay off some 500 pilots and 400 maintenance workers this year, along with a number of flight attendants. A spokesman for the air carrier says the world's largest airline will become somewhat smaller, and the layoffs are part of a transition plan to stop the air carrier from losing money. Earlier this year, American announced it will pull out of markets where it cannot effectively compete. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 4 points to close at 3,439.44 on volume of more than 232 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance has confirmed that he plans to step down as a UN mediator in the Bosnian crisis. Vance says that trying to stop the fighting in the area is the hardest job he has ever had. Vance says when he leaves will depend on UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. Vance refused to comment on whether he was disappointed that a UN peace plan for Bosnia had failed to get the complete backing of the Clinton administration. The plan has been signed by Muslim and Croatian leaders, but not by Serbian factions. Four men, federal officials allege, are members of a radical Palestinian group, are in custody following an indictment released in St. Louis. Federal authorities allege the four ran a racketeering operation and conspired to kill a teenage girl. Mark Minnelli of member station KWMU reports.
The grand jury indictment claims the four are members of the terrorist group Abu Nidal. James Nelson, special agent in charge of the St. Louis FBI office, says the investigation began in 1986.
Specific acts charged include the murder of 16-year-old Tina Issa here in St. Louis in 1988, conspiracy to murder Jews, a discussion on blowing up the Israeli embassy in Washington, interstate travel and aid of racketeering, failure to file reports of monetary transactions and passport violations.
One of the four men, Zane Issa, was convicted in 1991 along with his wife of murdering their 16-year-old daughter. The indictment alleges she was killed to keep her from talking about her father's activities. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Minnelli in St. Louis.
Police in Wilmington, North Carolina say a bullet has been removed from the body of actor Brandon Lee, who died yesterday during filming on a movie set. A prop gun used in the scene was intended to fire blanks, and a police statement did not say if the bullet was fired with a prop gun. Lee was the son of the late actor Bruce Lee. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Imagine the Miss America beauty pageant, but with young men in evening gowns, and you'll get a sense of what the 1967 Miss All-American Camp beauty pageant was like. It was held at New York's Town Hall, where it was judged by luminaries of the art world and underground like Andy Warhol, Terry Southern, and Larry Rivers. The drag pageant was produced by Jack Doroshow, who hosted it in his drag alter ego, Sabrina. Doroshow spent most of the 60s producing regional competitions around the country. The 1967 national pageant was the subject of a documentary called The Queen. After the success of the recent film Paris is Burning about Harlem drag queens, there was a renewed interest in The Queen. This led the executive producer of the documentary, Lewis Allen, to re-release it. Allen has also produced such Broadway hits as Annie and A Few Good Men. We invited Lewis Allen and Jack Doroshow to join us. Jack narrates the film. Here he is describing his drag alter ego, Sabrina, the masterful mistress of ceremonies, and her relationship to the beauty queens of the pageant.
I don't try to compete with them. Look, I'm 24 years old, but in drag I come on like 110, and I do this whole bar mitzvah mother thing, you know, gaudy gowns and pushy, but it's a good relationship with them because they don't fear me as competition. They respect me, and it's commercial.
Would you describe what you'd wear and how you'd make up?
Oh, what I'd wear would be sort of like something, if your listeners know Leonard's of Great Neck.
Leonard's of Great Neck is the place in Long Island where they'd have like 100 bar mitzvahs at one time with a few weddings in there also.
That's the place.
So you came off as if you were what at Leonard's of Great Neck?
Just about anybody there, I guess, except I was wearing the chandelier as well. No, it was just, you know, basic rule was how gaudy can you get?
And why would you promote drag shows instead of competing in them?
You're so kind. Well, I wouldn't say I'm a dog, but I'm kind of a funny-looking guy, and I don't think I'd be too good at that stuff. Mind you, I'll try anything, but I don't think that would have come off so swell. I mean, I like clowning around, and for me, drag is clowning around. I think it's that simple.
There's a scene in the movie The Queen, in the documentary, of shopping for clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Would you work with the contestants to go shopping, or would they use what they already had? I mean, were they on their own, or did you help them with their look?
Let me put it this way. They were certainly responsible for, you know, bringing their own act. But their work, compassionate, sensitive, understanding, and caring individuals around us that took time to, like, you know, do what they could. So, it wasn't like a strict rule, nobody's going to help you, because everybody tried to help everybody. It was a nice thing. It was better than kicking the head. People, I think, very nice.
What were the best places in New York for a man who wanted to dress as a woman to go shopping?
Well, today there are specific places for that. But if you're asking about the time when I was doing the contest, that's quite different. In those times, there were a few old drag queens who had gone into the dressmaking business. These would be maybe kids that had retired from the 82 Club or from the Jewel Box Review. Maybe they were dragging one leg or had a bit of a stroke or had a funny finger, and I just decided not to be a performer anymore. But they could sew a wild dress, you see. And then that would be their trade. Now, today you have regular public venue. There's a guy called, something or other, Mardi Gras Boutique. I can't think what it is. And that place has everything, platform shoes and false boobies and false tushies and, oh my, I mean, it's just amazing. It's, you know, you come right off the street and there it all is for you. But back at earlier times, it was something you had to know someone that did that or put it together yourself. I don't think there was a lot of shopping going on in public department stores unless they were guys who already were able to look like ladies and stuff like that, because I think people frowned on that kind of stuff.
So how did you do the false boobies, as you put it?
In my case, I went to a woman called Madame Bertha, who was a costumer here in New York City. And she did Vegas showgirls and drag queens and all kinds of stuff. And she knew all about that stuff. She understood every single aspect of it, and she'd been at it for a long, long time. And so it was, you know, one-stop shopping for all intent and purpose. There was a guy called Barris that made wigs, and there was Madame Bertha that made dresses, and came as a package deal.
Jack Darshow is my guest. He produced drag beauty pageants through the 1960s. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jack Darshow, producer of the 1967 Miss All-American Camp Beauty Pageant. A documentary about it called The Queen has just been re-released. Also with us is the film's executive producer, Lewis Allen. Now, I know you produced drag shows from New York to the Ozarks. When you'd get to a smaller rural place, a place outside of a center like New York, which has always had a large gay population, was it a very different experience?
I remember after we had our most successful contest, which was in Atlanta, Georgia, around 1963, we decided to check out Savannah because we'd heard a lot about it from the kids. And we pulled into town and took a room in a little cheap place. And we were looking out the window. The streets were very, very quiet. It was a lazy afternoon in a sleepy little town. Weren't even any people out wandering around like walking dogs and things. My God, someone said, I don't think we ought to stay here. But in point of fact, good thing we did. They came hopping over the hills with hoop skirts and sausage curls by the thousands. We had to have a 3-day runoff before we could reduce the number, small enough to be able to do it in a single contest.
You must have been surprised.
Every day is a surprise. I mean, in that case, I was surprised. Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, who would have thunk?
What were your audiences like? Were your audiences mostly comprised of people who were part of the drag scene? Were they straight people, gay people, a mix of everything?
I think it was a very broad mix. Every kind of situation imaginable. There were people from Hollywood who found this to be an amusement. There were people from the local gay scene who found this to be a local event. There were folks that were kind of like following the scene around, checking it out, from a sort of sociological standpoint. And there were some fancy people that were slumming. You had a pretty broad combo, but the bulk audience was whatever was interested in the local gay scene until we did the national contest, in which case people would come in from various places, and then that was, if anything, a much greater cross-section.
You know, at the end of the 1967 national pageant, one of the runners-up walked off the stage, you know, being very upset that you know, he didn't win. And then there's a little, like, dishing contest afterwards, in which this bitter runner-up says that Harlow, who actually won, you know, doesn't deserve it, and she won because she's a friend of yours. And were you shocked that happened, or did this thing happen fairly regularly?
Oh, that was just as regular as clockwork.
Really?
Yeah, it goes in a package deal. I don't know. I mean, they never show us backstage at Miss America.
Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, because of Lewis Allen's eye in there, we saw the whole picture on that Miss America, but we don't know what goes on the one down Atlantic City. I'd like to check that out. Maybe it's the same. We had it a lot. Yeah, you know, I mean, some guys took it really, really seriously, and they got pissed if they didn't win. And other people, you know, maybe didn't think that was a realistic goal. They weren't going to win anyhow. And other people thought they did have a good chance, but they were gentlemen about it and they didn't make a big deal. And then some guys get really pissed.
What would you say to the contestants who were bitter and couldn't accept the fact that they didn't win?
I don't know. I'd try to say what my Aunt Sadie would say.
Which was what?
Oh, you know, something like the glass is half full and look on the bright side, Toots, and all that kind of stuff. Oh, and you look great tonight.
Do you watch the Miss America pageant now?
No, ma'am.
Why not?
I never really watched the Miss America contest. I mean, I thought it was... I thought it was exploitive. I didn't think the ladies that were doing that really wanted to do that stuff. I felt as if somebody was like, I don't know. I mean, the guys in their contest really wanted to do that. That's what they wanted to do. They were happy as clams to do that. With the Miss America contest, I was always kind of suspicious. Maybe those ladies would have rather do something else, you know?
Have you kept up with any of the people who competed in your pageants?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yeah, sure.
What's happened to some of them?
Oh, there's so many stories and different things and all. I mean, some of them have bars and some of them own movie theaters and some of them have had sex changes and gotten married and some of them have gone off to foreign places and gotten different names and become different people. And it's so many things. I mean, one of them is a teacher for a political family, and one of the guys took over his father's bank, and he's a pompous little banker. I don't know, different stuff, you know.
Harlow, who won the nationals, the pageant that's documented in the movie The Queen, she had a sex change operation afterwards and went from a he to a she. Were you surprised at that? And I wonder what your reaction has been to friends of yours who've had sex change operations.
I was pissed.
Why?
I didn't think it was a good idea. I just thought it was, I don't know, I thought it was a great idea to be able to wash the stuff off, you know. But I thought that was a little more complicated. I don't know. It scared me. I didn't understand it.
So you related to the idea of drag more as theater than as being trapped in the wrong body.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Harry Benjamin came up with that idea about trapped in the wrong body and stuff. And Harry Benjamin... a very, very nice man, very dear man, I think quite well-purposed. But I don't think Dr. Benjamin knew diddly-squat about drag queens. Absolutely nothing. I think some guys wanted to have sex changes, so I think that's probably valid. But I'm afraid it had a lot to do with, I don't know, social pressures or peer group pressure or something weird like that. I don't think it had to do with the guys being trapped in anything except their own ideas. But I must tell you that Richie's happy as a clam and looks gorgeous. And
this is Harlow.
This is Harlow. Oh, I mean, gorgeous. So, I don't know, maybe it's cool.
I might interpolate here that Harlow got married, was married for quite a while.
No.
Was a housewife, had a stepchild.
Had a stepdaughter, that's right.
And lived in the suburbs of Philadelphia for quite a while. And I must say, at the opening party the other night, she was sitting next to Mario Buata, who talked to her at great length and was found her charming. He finally said, listen, why were you... This was about a drag contest. Why were you in the picture? What were you doing in the picture? She said, what? He said, what were you doing in that? And she said, but I was a boy then. He didn't realize she looks like a really a housewife now, doesn't she?
Yes.
Beautiful housewife.
Yes. Yeah. It's generally a different person. I mean, getting a sex change is a full-time job. I mean, getting in drag is, I don't know, it's a lark.
Has the meaning of drag changed for you in the past 25 years? And do drag shows look different to you? Does the whole, like, drag subculture look different to you now than then?
Well, I mean, it feels different because I'm an Alta Cocker. I mean, everything feels, you know what I'm saying? So,
explain that for our listeners who don't speak Yiddish.
An Alta Cocker is like an old person, like maybe taking a little water on the port side. You know, you're just slower and, I don't know.
Okay.
Just up in years, as my grandmother used to say, up in years. So, you know, the viewpoint's different, sure, you know.
Jack Darashaw produced the 1967 Miss All-American Camp Beauty Pageant. A documentary about it called The Queen has just been re-released by Lewis Allen, the executive producer of the film. Today it completes a two-week run at the Film Forum in New York. It opens in Chicago next week, comes to the Washington Film Festival in D.C. later this month, and is expected to open in other cities soon. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, you were recently in Hungary, and I believe today you're going to continue your reports on Hungarians.
That's right, on Hungarians who live outside Hungary, in the countries neighboring. Today, Transylvania, which until World War I was part of Hungary. It's been part of Romania ever since. It's been a troubled and contested area in the past. And we'll be talking with the mayor of the city of Cluj, who has won notoriety and a lot of votes by antagonizing the Hungarian minority in that city. Also, Ted Clark reports today on President Bill Clinton's foreign policy address in Annapolis. And Noah Adams reports on some new uses for compost.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of Philip Roth's new novel, Operation Shylock.
By now, you've probably heard so much about Philip Roth's new novel, you may even think you've already read it. This would be as postmodernist as Shylock itself, like those reviews by Jorge Luis Borges and Italo Calvino and Stanislaw Lem of books that don't happen to exist. Just as postmodernist are all the publicity interviews in which Roth preempts criticism on what's real and what's not, which are themselves parodies of disposable consumer culture, the chat as gig, like the novel as therapy. So someone calling himself Philip Roth writes a book about going to Jerusalem to mix it up with someone else pretending to be Philip Roth, who promotes something called diasporism, which would send all the Jews back from Israel to the European countries where they became most distinctly Jewish in the first place. These two Roths sleep with the same shiksa, Wanda Jane Pozeski, a recovering anti-Semite and the most tantalizing layer cake of female excitement since Strindberg, or so we are told by one of the Roths. It doesn't matter which, since they end up pretending to be each other. Meanwhile, both Roths are diving in and out of the King David Hotel, or off to the trial of Ivan the Terrible of Treblinka, or lost on the road to Ramallah, where Israeli soldiers treat them like terrorists. Not only is the Israeli Secret Service, Mossad, involved, and Arafat, and the second Oswald, and Saul Bellow's victim, and Dostoevsky's underground man, but so are the counterfeit travel diaries of Leon Klinghoffer, as well as a check for $1 million, which one Roth loses, perhaps in a halcyon fuzz, while the other is dying of cancer and resentment. I haven't mentioned Gollum yet, or Kafka, or Nabokov, or penal implants, not even Irving Berlin, the nice Jewish man who wrote Easter Parade and White Christmas. Whether the Roth who says he wrote this book really went to Athens to spy for Israel, while the other Roth who claims to be a Chicago detective is actually the Moshe Pippick who fooled around with Anne Frank, doesn't matter, except maybe to semioticians and Commentary Magazine and other Umberto Ecos. Since Philip Roth at age 60 isn't going to change, what does matter is that since he's such a big talker, we should listen to him. And what he's talking about most of the time in Shylock, from every feverish point of view, is Israel. His Arab friend from Chicago days may be furious at him. "What do an oppressed people's problems matter to a great comic artist like you?" shouts George. "You're a very amusing performer and a moral idiot." But Roth is obviously a lot more sympathetic to George's point of view than Saul Bellow would be. Even his Mossad spymaster, Smilesberger, is made to say of the Palestinians, "They are innocent. We are guilty. They are right. We are wrong. They are the violated. We the violators. I am a ruthless man working in a ruthless job for a ruthless country, and I am ruthless knowingly and voluntarily." And yet, of course, Roth himself won't buy any analogy to Hitler's horror. "Look," he cries, "Nazis didn't break hands. They engaged in industrial annihilation of human beings. They made a manufacturing process of death. Please, no metaphors where there is recorded history." It seems to me that this Philip Roth, on a brilliant talking jag about the end of metaphor and the Jew in history, may even be profound.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Operation Shylock by Philip Roth. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, gangs, truces, and the LAPD. Jim Gallipo returns to Fresh Air to tell us more about his work as a probation officer in South Central LA. He's worked with gang members for 27 years. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.